Hey guys, it's Mark Potter, publisher of Canvas Magazine, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Brushstrokes, a podcast powered by Canvas Magazine. Today's episode is sponsored by Conduit Incorporated, www.conduit-inc.com, where channeling content and connections is our business. Today's guest, guys, is Terry Marks. He's the principal of T. Marks Design. He is a wonderful designer. He's done some fabulous work with companies like Potlatch, Nina, Howe. He's done some award-winning stuff. But really, the message of today is not so much about design and the business of design. It's more of a general message in terms of how we connect. Terry has had a really interesting life, and he shares a bit of that in our conversation. And he talks a lot about how things have changed, you know, and how it's changed at the marketer's level. And so I think there's a lot of lessons to glean, and I really believe you're going to enjoy it. We had a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, and it's a breath of fresh air. Certainly was for me, and I can't wait to connect with him again. So I really hope you enjoy this. I hope you continue to enjoy Brushstrokes. It is a lot of fun to drum up these conversations, and I look forward to your feedback. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Terry Marks.
This is Terry. Is this Mark?
This is. How are you?
Not unwell. How are you?
That's a good answer.
I stole it from George Carlin.
The late George Carlin.
Yeah, he was better than I realized when I listened to him as a kid. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't make him like that anymore, you know?
They had because you're not allowed to say the things he said anymore.
I know. Isn't it terrible? I mean, you know, he was so funny. He and Richard Pryor.
Oh my gosh.
They were hysterical.
Richard Pryor actually scared me a little bit when I was a kid because it's like, wow, I can't believe he said that.
I know.
But it was great. It was great.
It's kind of like rock bands. You know, back in the day, there was a mystery to rock bands. I always, you know, ask people, you know, I mean, I always ask people.
Because they were out there. They weren't people that you could know anything about.
Yeah. Like you would say to somebody, hey, you went to a Led Zeppelin concert? I mean, you imagined what that was like. You imagined what it looked like.
And you went to a Who concert and you're alive?
Right.
That's amazing.
And then and then you remember, like, you know, the stories would get larger than life, you know. Ozzy Osbourne, you know, bites the head off of a bat, or no way. Did you were there, you saw that kind of stuff. So
Alice Cooper and all that. You know, Justin Aarons knows Alice Cooper, and he does a fundraiser with him every year.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, he's really into golf. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, so Justin knows him probably from Arizona.
Exactly.
How do you know Justin?
Well, it was an experimental phase in college. I think I know Justin probably from AIGA stuff.
Okay.
Out here, we had a Seattle retreat. I think that was the first time I really spent a lot of time talking to him, and he asked if we could possibly collaborate on something. I said sure, and so we did a number of collaborations. How do you know Justin?
He and I are going to probably talk a little bit about collaborating. He actually spoke at one of my events a couple years ago. He did a fabulous job, and he worked with an O'Neill Printing out in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And they were a client of mine, and he's a fabulous guy. And his story, I don't know if you've either read his book or heard him speak, but his story is really, really good. And he's done some amazing stuff. You know, his work in Africa is fabulous. His trek across Canada on his bike and losing all his weight, and pretty cool stuff. But really thoughtful and so I got to know him through those guys, and then he spoke and he killed it. And so I recently just reached out to him to say, you know, we should collaborate on some stuff. So That's cool.
That's great.
Yeah, like-minded people, I guess they flock together. That's cool. So how are things in Seattle?
Shockingly sunny.
Really?
It's officially fall, and, you know, we've been really sunny. It's crazy. I mean, the last 2 years, my wife is a gardener, and I'm out in my little study out here, and I'm looking across the garden. It's this enormous, fecund, expansive green and flowers still. We had tomatoes arriving in June, which doesn't happen in Seattle because it's never hot enough.
Right.
But it's great. Seattle's a crazy town right now just because, you know, all the tech, all the startups and tons of money being poured into downtown. If you close your eyes for 5 minutes, there's 6 new condos. They literally can't build anymore because all the cranes on the West Coast, building cranes, are booked up for the next 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I think that, you know, makes me think.
Is it cool? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's funny. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day. I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking about that part of the country and that city and how it's fallen on tough times because manufacturing has moved out. And I said, gosh, you know, it was such a wonderful place to grow up, and it's got the lake and the bay, and it's actually pretty neat, and it's close to some neat cities. How do you revitalize towns like that? And then you hear about bigger towns like Seattle or even Atlanta. I mean, they're just booming. And,
right.
You know, I wonder, you would think that those little towns would be ripe for reinvention, you know?
I think they actually are. There's this thing happening in the West where people who have either cashed out because they were at Microsoft for 20 years,
yeah,
or just got tired of the rat race, or moving to the little towns and counties in the east of Washington and Oregon, like Wallawa, and they're doing organic farms and these cool hotels and revitalizing stuff. And to me, it's inevitable that cities that maybe got bypassed in some booms are going to feel that same kind of resurgence. I mean, if this continues in any fashion. In fact, that's really interesting to me, that kind of thing, although my brain is... I'm short attention span theater. Mm-hmm. My wife would love to go, you know, have 30 head of cattle, 20 acres, and do all the things.
Yeah.
She's begging me to get a goat right now. I'm like, hard pass, no goats.
A goat.
I said, well, you know, if you don't like getting the chickens out of the neighbor's yard, how about when the goat is eating their child's clothing? You know, that's just not going to go well.
Yeah.
We could have a goat a week a year. That's it. I almost went right to the carnivore answer. We'll have a goat for a week and we'll roast him.
That's awesome.
Then we're good. Maybe we can dig a pit. We can do it that way. Just like the Hawaiian.
I love it.
So why did you want to talk to me?
You know, obviously you were gracious enough to help us with an article in Canvas, and I don't know if you've got... I'm assuming we sent you copies. If we haven't, we better send you. But you
I have not seen copies, but I've read it online, and a couple people pinged me and said, hey, that was great to see you there.
It was. And, it was really good. And then I read through it, and I thought, did I know you? I know you did work for Potlatch. Right?
Oh, my gosh. I think my first or second design award ever was from Potlatch.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That was a million years ago.
I grew up. Did you ever know Patty Groh?
Yeah.
So she's one of my closest friends, and yeah. So I mean, there's some when I read that, and I know Michael had reached my editor had reached out to you, and I thought, God, I'm telling you, I know Terry, and then first thing you're talking about Justin. So I don't know. Maybe I wanted to talk to you because it was just by osmosis, but I was really compelled, you know, reading that little Q&A with you within Canvas. It was just really interesting to see the perspective. You know, you're dealing with clients in a creative way. Obviously, you're someone who deals with print, not only by promoting it, but also people are calling on you. And I thought, you know, it's important for me. Canvas has been really kind of a different voice in the industry about how to connect with people. And while I don't necessarily want this conversation to be, hey, tell me what you think about print, because I think that's been done to death, I prefer to talk more about your business and how you see things. I just think that the world needs conversations with people who are passionate about the industry and see things a little bit differently. So I just was compelled, and I said, Michael, maybe we could reach out to him and you know, talk to him and get his views on it. So I could ask you some things about how you make money and how you see how design has changed and how people.
Well, the police aren't going to hear this, are they?
No. They've got their hands full right now. They have their hands full. But that's, you know, that's kind of how it came about. And certainly I know you've got some interest and passion around print, but maybe step back and talk a little bit about how you got into the business and, you know, give me a little chronology of your world.
Wow. You really want to hear this. Okay.
I do.
You talk about print, and I'll get there next. We'll talk about the etymology of my becoming a designer. I'll try to make it as brief as possible. I was the kid who always drew. You know, it was the thing that I had. I can remember drawings that I did in kindergarten and first grade. And it was just something I had. And my dad worked for the American Red Cross. And so he was a social worker, essentially, but he was always in charge of the Red Cross services.
Was this in Seattle?
Well, no. My dad worked for the American Red Cross, and he always worked in conjunction with the military.
So
he was stationed on either Air Force, Marine, or Army bases. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, that's how we met my mother back in the 50s. And so I was born in Eastern Washington, in a now-defunct Air Force base. In fact, when I moved back to Washington State, somehow they found my name through some registry, and I was getting the Hanford Health Network newsletter.
Yeah.
If you don't know, Hanford is a nuclear facility, and so I was super freaked out, like, what are you trying to tell me? Am I going to become a mutant? If I get powers, very cool.
How you got into the creative side of things.
Yeah, well... So I was born in Eastern Washington. Before I was a year old, we moved to Hawaii for 4 years, then Sacramento, then Denver, then I lived in Japan for 4 years, and then I lived on an Air Force base for the first and only time in my life in Japan, Yokota Air Force Base. It was fantastic, and without knowing it, I think it informed a lot of how I saw the world, especially from a design and visual standpoint. And we ended up moving back to a town about an hour south of Seattle. It was technically Tacoma, but I went to Puyallup High School. And and it was kind of like, what I say is, it was like moving on to the Dukes of Hazzard set. And I had been, all my friends were literally from all over the globe. And then we went to a town where a lot of people hadn't left the state. And it was pointed out to me, my mother's Korean, my dad's Euro mutt, that I was a minority and hadn't ever really thought about it. And it was a weird time. I did all right in school and all that good stuff. But I kind of ignored these natural abilities I had around visuals and writing and things like that.
Right.
You know, I took college chem and college English and all that. And I ended up going to a small liberal arts college, largely because they were small enough, I thought I could walk onto the football team. And and somehow that panned out. But while I was there, I did all the things I wouldn't deem to do in high school. Like I wrote a column for the school paper. I acted in university productions, did film and video projects with friends, and I leaned into the art. And I thought I was going to be pre-med, and I ended up not really loving it. And by the fourth year, the administration office actually contacted me and said, if I don't declare a major, they're going to bounce me out of school. So I looked like, what am I close to? So I ended up getting a bachelor's degree in communications, emphasizing PR. And I was staying an extra semester to finish my last year of football. And I realized I could get a BA in art as well. if I took a couple classes in the spring, and I did that. And I audited the upper level graphic design course. I'd never taken any graphic design. But I switched it for a sculpture class, and I ended up getting an internship at a design studio in town. Hmm. I was the only one that the prof recommended. It was weird. I didn't know what a portfolio was. I literally had to borrow a physical portfolio, and I don't know what they were looking for. I still don't know. And I took in life drawings and paintings and articles I'd written and the one paste up I had ever done. And they gave me an internship and paid me. It was bizarre.
That's wild.
And they hired me before I graduated, and they said they wanted me to be an account manager. I said, okay, that's cool, but can I sit on the side where all the artists are? And I was just hungry to do something because, yeah, I'd largely ignored this stuff.
Right.
So I would sneak back in after hours when no one was there so I could use the stat machine and just make stuff. I was just so hungry to do something.
Yeah.
And that was my education, really started there. After that, I ended up as the publications manager for the Tacoma Pierce County Chamber of Commerce.
Cool.
And while I was there, a former colleague at my former job contacted me. She had a friend whose family did really well, and he was at the forefront of selling MRI machines
okay.
to health facilities. And she said, would you consider doing his identity and doing his presentation stuff? And so I did that, and I made almost as much money on that freelance job as I did during a month in
wow.
my regular job. And I thought, once I get back from Mexico spending all that money, I'm going to do more freelance. That's exactly what I did. And so I ended up, for about 6 months, I had more work outside than I did for my regular job. And you've heard this a million times. But I was trying to slice it. I was young. I didn't think I needed to sleep. And my roommate at the time, who's one of my best buddies, he used a technical term to describe how I was. And he said, dude, I just need to tell you, you're a complete jackass to live with. And so I quit my job. I thought, okay, this is easy. You know, people are just going to give me work. And I was hell bent for leather for about 6 months. And then reality set in. I didn't really know, obviously, how to run a business. And the idea of a pipeline or sales
yeah.
or actual marketing, oh my gosh, learn the hard way.
Yeah.
Really learn the hard way. But things happened quickly and well, and I'd always wanted to move up to Seattle. I was living in Tacoma at the time, and I moved up to Tacoma and just started going. And I had more than enough work, and I was still knowing that I was a poser, completely, totally a poser. And so I was learning as I went. Clients seemed happy, and I used to take informational interviews, either with someone I'd heard about or someone I'd read about.
Right.
And, you know, very much tail between my legs. I would ask them for 5 minutes. And if they were kind enough to meet with me, often 5 minutes turned into 45 minutes and sometimes 2 or 2.5 hours. And in the course of that, I learned a lot because I developed a vantage point. I started to learn the landscape and started to understand what the industry was about, from advertising, from copywriting, to design, to illustration, because these are all the things I was interested in.
Right.
But at the time, this is the early 90s, there was no idea. There was no sense of, oh, if you're a designer, you can do print, UX, and video, and whatever else you want, which is kind of the idea now. Then, if you want to do more than one thing, you were a hack.
Right, right.
And I never really bought that.
That's
so
before your time, I guess.
No, just, you know, that close to schizophrenia. So it was really wild. I would go on these informational interviews, and a couple times I was offered jobs. Like, would you like to be the director of new media here in this city you don't live in? I said, well, that sounds really interesting, but I just signed a 2-year lease on an office space.
Right.
So if you can buy that out and give me X amount per year, we're a go. And he said, well, we can't do that. And I said, well, I can't just, you know, pay 2 years worth of rent.
That's right.
And it turned out really well, and I started hiring people because I was too busy for my own good. And
how are you getting clients?
A lot of word of mouth. I didn't understand sales, obviously. I was still just a kid, really, really concerned about craft, because I value people who are excellent at what they do. I'm still fascinated. Like, if you've ever seen Jiro Dreams of Sushi, the 80-some-odd-year-old sushi chef in Japan, he still thinks, wow, I've got a long way to go. And he's thought is one of the best in the world. I appreciate that you're never done. And I knew that I was getting some skills. I was still kind of a hack. And I was lucky enough that the people I worked with, my clients, would pass me along and they would hear things. And I was really fortunate. I just, you know, things grew. And I think it was a time of somewhat low-hanging fruit. And when things were tense and we were suddenly going up against the big name firms for stuff, I was still going on charm and, you know, shuffling off to Buffalo, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's interesting though, to think about, you know, the people that are that you take note of that are excellent because they're in a mode of constant improvement that they've never gotten to the finish line. But that's rare, wouldn't you say, in this world?
Oh, gosh, especially now. We live in a world that if you have a computer, you can be a stockbroker, a designer, and whatever else you want. And it's a little weird. I have buddies who have shot like any commercial you can think of, any major commercial, national spot. They've shot it, and as the advertising world got topsy-turvy, young guns who had a Canon 5D and a bank of LED lights were suddenly being hired to do national work.
Yeah.
Even though they didn't know how to work with a crew, and you know, it's a bit of hyperbole there, but there's some truth in that. And as the digital advent came, you know how it is. Clients suddenly think, "Wow, you can do this now. We don't have to wait." And it used to be that you'd send type for typesetting and you'd wait 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different thing. Now you're shooting stuff out the door the same day. That's the need. It's wild. It's cool. But totally different expectations. You were going somewhere with that line of questioning.
I do. It's interesting to me. And I'm going to tell you, there's a conversation my creative director and I always have. And we talk about how, and this isn't that design is a commodity, that just about anything is a commodity, that it's still, you still need that listening mechanism. You know, you can design a Picasso.
I was on the internet.
Right. But if you design a Picasso, but the community that you send it out to doesn't like it, then it doesn't mean anything. It's just noise. I wonder how that, if that is in your mindset in terms of how value is created. Meaning, I mean, you can go to these Fiverr sites now and all this kind of stuff with design and you know, some of the
I've
basic
worked with clients who do that, and sure. I encourage them, hey, if that's what you want to do, because price is the most important thing, do that. Go.
Yeah.
And you're hitting the nail on the head. Design is largely commoditized. I think China is churning out graphic designers and creative talent along with everything else,
mm-hmm.
10 times the rate we are. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it is going to be commoditized. We're in a really, really busy business environment where young guns who are really talented coming out of school are nailing jobs that people who have been in the industry 20 years would be thrilled to receive that kind of salary,
right,
and that kind of treatment. But I remember friends who were recruiters in 2001, when everything kind of dropped, they were placing young people and people fresh out of school in jobs getting 75 grand a year to start. And they would no-show because they wanted more money. And then the economy tanked and who knows what they ended up doing, right?
Yeah, working at the local coffee shop.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And there is a commoditization of this. And I think good design has always been about understanding and executing more than design. I have good clients who value strategy, and sometimes even they step in on their own toes and start to think of what we do, what I do, as, oh, wow, he's really good. I know he can do this in no time. And forget the factors of rush costs, understanding the full scope of the entire mission that you're on. Because that listening component is the reason why I even pervade. It's pretty strange. I've had a number of good designers who've worked in my studio. And right now, I'm doing what I thought I'd never really do, where it's me and my office manager, and I have a cadre of photographers and videographers and coders and some production illustration people that I use on a semi-regular basis. But I'm doing a lot more consulting. But the great thing about that is I'm really only working on things that I know that I can make a positive contribution to, and that's going to be a mutual thing for the client and us, and it's not just about the exchange of money, but hopefully I can really add something. And when we're talking about the mission of an entity and how do we bring that to market, so there's a strategy component, then I'm really interested. This is something I care about. And in fact, I'm on retainer with a couple clients, and it's because I'm working with the person who was called in one instance to get this revamped their website, and it turned into more than a year-long process of rebranding and rebuilding the mission and every single touch point. And now he and I are scripting their new marketing strategy and how to do that. And that includes creating a 21st floor living workplace lab to talk about how workplaces changed. It's for a major office furniture dealer out here. And they were seeing a similar thing. Everyone thought they were a commodity. And because they're a certified Herman Miller dealer, there's a ton of research about how workplaces changed, what that means, what are the most efficient and productive work modes, what's the cost of not creating the workspace. Because space allows, I was talking to some, get this, workplace psychologists who are informing this, and they were saying that space informs culture and opportunity. It's like, wow, this is really interesting, the tie between that. So it's a meaty thing. And so
it's an interesting thing that, you know, and I listened to the chronology of, you know, of how you got into it, and a lot of it is you jumping off the cliff and building your wings on the way down, but
hello, Icarus.
That's right. But I think about what you just said is amazing, and is and so I feel like there's no industry that has a monopoly on challenge. You know, the printing industry said, well, you know, there's so much competition, and it's more of a commodity, and I just don't see that, because you look at, we look at the creative world, we look at the design world, and we think, oh, they're just, you know, they're brilliant, they have a different mindset, they have different skill set, and yet it still comes down to who knows you. I mean, in the scope of this last few minutes, you've said to me, I find my clients, they find me essentially through referrals, and it's really more about my engagement. The value that I've created is more about my understanding of who they are and the intimacy that I have with them, as opposed to me being able to actually craft a logo. And
we both know the quality of the product doesn't mean that you're going to be financially successful. We both know studios and people who are killing it, and it might be said by more critical people that their product isn't really the best.
Right.
That's not always the thing. Are they satisfying what the client needs? And sometimes it's a perceived need. But I've noticed that when I'm in a meeting, we've been shortlisted, if I'm asking probing questions, which I can't help but do, if I get to three questions they can't answer, we almost always end up working with them. Right. And that's not the goal, but it's an observation I've made, because it shows that we might be looking for things more than, hey, can we make a pretty picture for you?
Sure.
And hope it works.
Do you segment? Do you use the knowledge you have with certain clients and say that look, this is who I'm defined by. I'm defined by clients that have similar issues, and so that's what makes me better for you? Or do you do a more of a mass appeal?
There's probably both. It really depends upon the situation. We only push hard. I tend to only push hard on things that I think are a great fit and I'm really excited about. Mm-hmm. And that might sound kind of wishy-washy, but I have a weird spread of clients right now.
Right.
Some that are in software. We do wine work here in Washington and down in Napa, and that includes online and packaging. And working with this huge, full boat rebrand of this multi-million-dollar furniture company. I mean, it's really exciting stuff. And now we're working with a rebrand and store reconfiguration for a major grocery chain, or mm-hmm. I'll say a grocery chain. It's Northwest. I want to say it's major. So it's a wide gamut of things, and I really like that.
Right.
Like I said, short attention span theater, but it falls to that kind of, I've never been great at just one thing. I'm a good illustrator. I'm a good writer. I'm a good designer. I'm good with online. I'm pretty good even with writing in motion and video stuff, but mm-hmm. there's never been one thing that's been that ruled the roost, so to speak.
Yeah, but it sounds like over the course of time that you got pretty good, because you knew about it all, that you got pretty good at connecting with clients and communicating with clients, and that's the value. I mean, they used to say, hey, focus on one thing and do one thing, but it's really more about, no, focus on one group or one, focus on people or clients, and you know, that's been our message to our readership, is that listen, what's sustainable is who knows you.
Mm-hmm.
What you do, we have our industry that you've seen is chock full of digital printing and inkjet printing, and they're pushing the envelope and all this stuff, and it's just not sustainable, right? There's one guy comes out with something that moves a little bit faster or looks a little bit sharper, and then...
And you'll always be chasing, and if you're selling features and benefits, that's typically not the way to win.
Right, right, exactly. And it's about establishing this community of people who know you. I used to say, people will go, listen, it's not what you know, but who you know. Well, that's not right, mm-hmm. because if they all think you're, an asshole, then it's about who knows you. It's who trusts you, who likes you. Is most of your business a derivative of you, or do you have sellers?
You know, I'd like to say I had have sellers. I think it's probably both, because I would say that there are some people who champion what I do who have created clients out of some of their competitors,
mm-hmm.
because they're in a like industry. I think the strongest, we just brought on a new client, and it's because they were referred to us by a client we had just done an enormous scope of work for, and said, yeah, just call this guy. And I was in a strange situation of being in the boardroom talking to the few decision makers. I said, well, who else are you speaking to? And they said, frankly, it's just you. You were referred by so-and-so, and we trust them. So I said, so you're telling me if we can agree on cost and that this would be a good association, we're a go. And they said, absolutely. And so before the end of the meeting, we had a contract signed, and check was in the mail. It was nuts.
That's so cool. So do you think, so turning our attentions to upstream a little bit. So when you're talking to clients, marketers, CMOs, directors, mm-hmm. whatever, marketing departments, what's changed with them over the years, do you think, the most?
Well, I think they have, if you're talking to someone who's running marketing, I think their scope of concerns have grown, because they're dealing with online more and social. They're trying to get more out of budgets, and depending upon the industry and how their particular company is doing, they've either got a big playground because they got a budget because they're killing it,
right?
Or they don't, and they're trying to stretch the dollars. And the problem is, if you're talking to someone who, even if they're a CMO, and they don't have the authority to make a call, then you're spitting into the wind a little bit. You have to talk to decision makers.
Yeah.
Because the kind of work that we're able to affect the most change, that I'm able to affect the most change and make a deep impact, is when you can throw a really bizarre idea at somebody who has not only the willingness to take a risk, but the ability to make the call. And I found pretty quickly when we were working with the largest companies, and you're talking to a manager who reports to six different people whose names you probably won't know and certainly will never meet, that you can't do your best work, and you'll always be walking on coals, hot coals, to get things done. And that doesn't foster good work or good relations.
Yeah. You and I are like kindred spirits. Now I know, you know, even more why I wanted to talk to you, because it's fascinating. I deal with the same thing. You know, we do a lot of custom content and I came from the corporate world. I ran marketing for a large organization.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, it is it's so frustrating, because sometimes you feel like you're dealing with people who are just trying to validate their existence. You know, you probably have to deal with the ROI question quite a bit. And you've got that component. You've got the component that you were just talking about, is that, you know, who's the real decision maker? You know, you marry the two together, and you've got somebody who's doesn't really want to stick their neck out and wants to, anything they do, they need to show a return for, but they don't really have the decision, so they got to get six people to buy in, right?
Right. They're playing CYA, and you kind of can't blame them for it, because they don't have the authority to take a risk. They're protecting their budget and, frankly, their job.
Yeah.
And that's when you're in that conversation of, okay, regardless of who you're talking to, I really think you need to do X, Y, and Z. But you've been asked to do X. What's the cost of not having success? And they say, what do you mean? Well, is there a financial implication if this thing fails? And in fact, how does that affect you?
Right.
And if they're willing to be honest, it always goes to, this would be a major blow for the company. We can't fail. And if it does, I'll lose my job. You know, that's sometimes the fact of it.
Yep.
And
yep.
If they're honest, and because a lot of times people are just saying, oh, we just need to get it done. It's just time to put some new makeup on our website.
Yeah. All right.
Well, why? Is it important? Of course it's important, but and if you can't get them to be honest about the why, then you can't really do good work for them.
Sure.
Because you don't know what's at stake. You don't know what success looks like. You don't. Yeah. Anyway, you know.
Well, do you find, and this goes to any business, whether you're, you know, selling creative services, you're selling print, publishing, or custom content, whatever it is, do you find? I used to be adamant that listen, we can certainly take business that, in the short term, that we know is not going to be sustainable. They may give us something this time and then we're out right after it. You know, my philosophy is I can do business to keep the lights on in the short term with someone I don't really like, but I'm not going to count on them, you know, and I compartmentalize that. But the real business, the real meat, is going to be in those people that I like, that I hit it off with, that there's chemistry, that there's going to be some longevity to the relationship. My question is, these people, the names change so quickly. You can be doing this great deal with someone, and in 12 months later, you get the call going, hey, I've taken another role, or I'm out. And so, you know, how do you define long-term relationships anymore? You know,
well, like, you can't. I've always said that everything is like dating, especially having clients.
Right.
Because you keep going, and as long as there's that mystery, and this is kind of fun and positive, and once someone thinks, oh, I don't know, it's over. It's already over. Because by definition, having a client is not permanent, just like dating. And that's okay. Because sometimes I've developed great friendships out of clients. And we got a call one time from a food purveyor who heard of us through another client at a cocktail party, of course, something like that. And they had just bought a food company that needed some help and needed repackaging. We ended up repackaging that, helping them launch two other new lines with multiple offerings in those. And after a few years, it was a great relationship, just the back and forth. After a few years, I got a call from this guy saying, hey, I wanted to say thank you. You've done a great job, and I've never told you this, but it turns out that each of the lines that you redid for us doubled in sales 2 years in a row. I'm like, you're kidding me. He's like, yeah, it's fantastic. It's much more than we would have expected. And I was thinking, holy cats, am I getting the first, bonus I've ever gotten as designer? And the next phrase was, in fact, it went so well that we got bought by the largest food purveyor in the U.S. So we're out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, well, that's the thanks I get. Right? But that's what, it's just what it is. You create success and sometimes you don't get a piece of it. And that's just kind of what it is.
Well, I definitely need to come out there, and we need to have beers and solve the world's trouble, because your dating analogy, I've used it so many times. It is, even though I'm too old and too married to do that anymore.
Gosh. Last night, my wife called and said, I'm taking the girls to dinner at so-and-so's house because I was supposed to have beers with somebody. And I was, and the guy I was supposed to have beers with said, dude, I'm so sick. I'm like, oh my God, I have an empty evening. And I'm just like, do I go to the gym? Do I go to a bar? Do I go to a movie? What do I do? And I was just so flipped out. And of course, it evaporated because the client said, hey, can you get the stuff to us by tomorrow morning for this huge bin? I'm like, okay.
That's the way it goes. But the analogy that you say, I mean, I really appreciate the understanding, because at the first sign of doubt within the relationship, right?
Yeah.
It's over. I mean, if she's questioning what this is all about, do we need to take a break, kind of
really
deal? You're not going to go, hey, let's, can we talk about this? It's over.
And
cut the cord.
Yeah, it's done. Because your mom was right. There's a million fish in the sea.
And that's the question. So finding those fish in today's world. So speaking more to the sales side, and I think it's really interesting. We can look at the printing industry as a tangible thing, a manufacturing process. I can produce something.
Printing is really interesting to me. I love print. I love the artifact of it.
Oh, yeah. It's coming back into vogue. I mean, certainly it's smaller.
Well, it had to, and it's a different thing, because what happens? Everyone gets 3 million emails a day, and it's just noise. It's just noise. There's nothing to differentiate. With this huge rebrand, the CEO is like, we don't need to do print announcements, and I went ahead and designed it anyway, and they were like, oh, we have to do this.
Right.
And so they sent them to their top-tier clients, and it made a difference.
It made
a huge difference. Because if the idea is to differentiate, how do you do that in a way that supports who you are, what you're trying to say you do, in a way that is totally different than the competition, right?
Right, right. It's intimate. There's nothing more intimate, obviously, than talking or face-to-face. But the next level down is print. Our industry needs to certainly convey that. It's just hard in this day and age when everybody's TiVoing their way through life, right? They find you. They don't want anybody knocking on their doors. I mean, the lesson of your world is that they find you. What do you do to put the vibe out?
The vibe. Well, it's funny you ask that, because I'm just coming out of the deep childdom. My youngest daughter is 4, so I've been able to sleep a little bit for the last couple of years. And when I was really in the thick of it, I didn't really make time to do the thing that I think I maybe had a reputation for, which was doing my own work. And a lot of it, you know, I did it for the, in the form of promotional stuff.
Right.
In fact, I got a call from a guy who was a marketing director at a major window manufacturer in the area, and where he was reminiscing. Yeah, he used to send me stories, and they're like these little allegories that were funny, but maybe had a little message. And before the internet, before everyone had email, I used to fax them to people. You remember faxes?
Yeah.
And I would fax these little stories, and you know, they would just be a story, and I didn't ask for work. I just put it out there. And one time this guy called, he's national director of marketing. Yeah, you know the drill. He says, "Hey, Terry, we're having a slow day here at the office. And, you know, we haven't seen one of those funny stories from you in a while." And I said, "Really? You actually read those?" I said, "Here's the funny thing I'm noticing. I've been sending those for 3 years and I've never gotten a job." And he starts laughing, and they had me in the next day. And started about 3 years of work before, you know, the company ended up getting purchased by a bigger entity. And I've done everything from a lot of letterpress at Hat Show Print back in Nashville to the things everyone does, you know, coasters and T-shirts and just stuff I want to do for me. And it's a blast. I'm working actually on a couple of things right now, and I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. But you will be getting a new baseball cap with an embroidered logo soon.
Loving it. but what's the artist? So you know, right? You know, so that it's interesting. That's from the corporate marketer standpoint, or the CFO standpoint, who says, "Okay, you've been putting those little stories out for 3 years, and there was no business." But then somebody called and said, "Hey, man, where's my stories?" And the conversation started. So,
yeah, that's it.
That's where there's a disconnect. Don't you think the greatest companies on earth understand that you build a brand, you put the stuff out? I mean, if we could truly measure stuff, you know, we should all go to Vegas. I just don't. That's the thing that is so incredibly frustrating for me. To look at the greatest brands on earth spend gazillions of dollars building their following, and yeah. And you know, Apple is it, to me, they stood up and said, "I stand for you creatives." I mean, they even had a commercial that said, "I'm a Mac," and the suit was, "I'm a PC," and they basically said, "I'm with you guys and I'm not with them," and the world goes, "I like you," and they probably didn't say, "Oh, what's the ROI?" I mean, they could say, "Look, our sales went to here and we spent over the course of time," but that's the only ROI I can ever look at. But does that frustrate you as well?
It frustrates me to a degree. I'm actually really frustrated for people in the world of print, because I was lucky enough to be taught about print by some people who the company I worked at worked with, and well, go here and do the press check. And I'm like, "What's a press check?" And so I had to give up the ghost, like, "Hi, I don't know my ass from a hot rock here. Mm-hmm. And if you're kind enough, I'd really love you to teach me something." And some of those people became really, really good friends. And they taught me everything I know about print. Because I know this, when you get a beautiful piece of print, it blows your mind. It'll sit on your desk. Mm-hmm. And people say, "What's that?" Right? You might have a favorite comic book, a book, an invitation. I don't care if it's a wedding invite or, you know, a book of matches. That stuff makes a dent. And that's a marketer's dream, that you would actually remember who someone is and what they do. And it's sad to me that print has kind of gotten pushed to mass market four color with UV on it, either that or super high-end limited edition book printing. You know, there's not a lot in between.
Right.
And to me, that just says there's a huge opportunity to do print that's meaningful.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you know, again, you go back to that argument where somebody says, "Well, I don't want to spend all that money on print," and it's like, yeah, but you know,
no, you're not spending money on print. What you're doing is spending money to make a dent, to be noticed.
Right. Exactly. Whereas the 18, you know, the email that you just keep sending and I keep unsubscribing to, or I keep deleting. I spoke to a group a few months back and I told them, I said, look, you know, the open rate on an email from my wife is going to be 100%. If the content within that email is a picture of my kids, the click rate's 100%. That's one extreme. Right. Let's go to the other extreme. And I said, how many emails do you think I can delete? And I opened up my phone in front of them. It was 300 people. And I deleted 18 emails in 10 seconds. Yeah. And the immediacy of that moment, I could tell that I didn't like, trust, or have them as a priority in that moment, in that twitch of an eye. Whereas print, don't you think it buys you some time? It buys you some of that intimacy?
Yeah, I should certainly hope so, because, well, let's put it this way. If you get something that looks like either a bill or something special in the mail, you actually open it.
Yeah.
And you look at it. And it does take longer than deleting an email, which evidently I've done in the last year and thrown away client inquiries, because someone we're working with now said, yeah, we tried to start this last spring. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I emailed you and I think you deleted it. I'm like, oh. So, you know, there's that danger there too, because everything is noise. Everything is noise.
Yeah.
Unless they know it's not.
Right, right, right. Right.
It's true life. 100%. You bet. Absolutely. Because I like to continue breathing. I like having a key that works in the lock.
That's right. That's, you know, earlier when you said that your roommate said that you're a real ass to live with, you know, I thought, God, I had flashbacks to, you know, I think I heard that this morning. But but I here two things before I let you go, because this is awesome. And I'm coming out and we're gonna solve the world's troubles.
You got
but
it.
Let me ask you about one thing near and dear to my heart and then one thing near and dear to your heart. First, you deal with printers and probably have had a gazillion of them call on you over the course of time.
Oh yeah.
You know, how, from an advice standpoint, how do they need to change their game?
Don't sell the printer that you have. Show me great work. And just like you said, if you see something in a person that there's consonance. C.S. Lewis said, you know, friendship is that thing where you go, oh my gosh, aha, at last. Mm-hmm. I thought I was the only person in the world who cared about that.
Yeah,
and that's the moment friendship is born. That's what you're talking about right now, because I'm feeling the same thing. Mm-hmm. When you, at the end of the day, if you think, wow, we kind of care about some similar things, that's someone you can typically work with. It doesn't always have to be that way.
Right.
But when someone is passionate about what they do, they care about really servicing your client, because I look at what I do as a service thing. Maybe it's because I was a waiter and things like that growing up, but we provide a service for people. And I never understood people who can get away with, you know, being the auteur. And I'd probably make a lot more money if I was a complete prick. But I'm only about 90%. Never mind. but, you know, we provide a service. And when you work with somebody who understands that and who can help provide solutions and can say, hey, that's a really cool thing you're trying to do, how, just take a second, what about this?
Right.
And if they can add to it, wow, you're on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great stuff. That's cool. Well, let me ask you, so you know, in our little article that we did in Canvas, you talked about the AIGA Link program. So I'm going to give you your moment here to give it a little plug, because
well,
sounds
know, this
really,
is one
really
of many
cool.
Things. I've been lucky enough. My dad... Being part of the Red Cross, I spent most of my young weekends and evenings volunteering, because my dad had volunteered me. Mm-hmm. And we lived in Colorado, and I spent nights, you know, huddled around a candle trying to keep warm selling Christmas trees all winter. And instead of going to karate practice wearing my all-white gi, I was cutting and laying sod for the church and stuff like that.
Right.
So this idea of service is kind of baked into who I am and my family. And Link is one of the things that I've been lucky enough to be involved with. I was, gosh, I was tutoring two different kids from the Central District here in Seattle, and my friend Glenn Mitsui, along with Paula Wong, who was also a good friend, they had started doing art workshops at Franklin High School. There was a dearth of funding for education at the time. It was 1994, and Paula's daughter was a junior at that school and had gone to five funerals of friends who had been involved in gang violence. And so knowing that giving kids something creative as an outlet was important, we started hosting workshops with a guest artist once a month, and we didn't know what we were doing. We were paying for it out of our own pocket, and over time we got more formal because we understand that there's a component of self-efficacy that comes from doing something with success. To see someone who takes the raw talent they have, an illustrator, a painter, a designer, who turns that into their career, might be inspirational. When I was a young person, success was, you know, a doctor or a lawyer. And right. The idea of doing something in the arts was kind of a lark, and, you know, you're kind of stepping out of your best skills. Mm-hmm. Was the thought, and here I am. You know, I'm now a creative professional, thank God. And Link started with that kind of idea in mind, and we were able to secure a grant. We heard about this opportunity for grant money, and we thought, man, if we had 20 grand, we'd be so hot to go. So we asked for 50, hoping for 20. Weird thing, they gave us 50 grand.
Oh my gosh.
We gotta grow up fast. So we got we hired a administrator who is now the director of Make-A-Wish Foundation here in Seattle and a couple other states. She really helped us keep our noses clean, and we've been able to renew the grant for I think 16 years.
Wow.
We work with students from about 8 or 9 different high schools. We're able to award $25,000 a year in scholarships, teacher portfolio workshop. All the workshops are free. We just ask that students continue to attend and not miss more than 2 unexcused. It's been an honor to be a part of it, quite frankly. We're in a place where former students, I think 6 former students currently, 5 former students, are now either on the leadership team or are active volunteers helping run the program. So it tells me we've done something right.
Yeah, my gosh, you should be proud of that. That's a big deal. I got to tell you, I think there's something to be said for guys like you and guys like Justin, where there is some success as defined by, you know, traditional measurements. But isn't it interesting that there a lot of those people who are truly successful in today's world, there's a purpose that's driving them, and they tend to give back, you know. And I look at the two of you guys, it's just a part of who your makeup is. This isn't smoke and mirrors, as you said earlier. It's not a poser or being a poser. It's that's the makeup, and that's the value that is derived. And I think we need more of that in this world. You know, everything becomes a commodity when, you know, I just want to get in and do this thing and sell this thing.
I want to make a lot of money. I want to get recognized and win this award. So I'm going to do this volunteer thing so everybody thinks I'm a good guy. That's mercenary. And we see it, and not everybody recognizes it. And, you know, that's fine. Yeah. My dad would always say, I think it's from Shakespeare, the truth will out. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, just the fact that someone's doing something that's putting something good out in the world, hey, that's great. That's beautiful. You know, run with it. More of it, like you said. And if everybody had an idea like that, there'd still be problems in the world. We'll never reach nirvana or heaven here, and that's fine. But if there was more concern for the other person, maybe I wouldn't have the road rage I do sometimes. And
right. Right.
Maybe it'd be a little bit more equitable and happy place to be. But, it is.
Well, you should be proud, Terry. I'm certainly proud that you took the time to speak with me. I'm coming out. We're going to go grab a bite, and we're going to solve the world's troubles. And, you know, if I can help at all with any of that, I'm happy to do it. I think that your story is a good one, and I'm you know, this is kind of what we've done. We just want to find, I'm not looking to go interview, you know, Donald Trump. You know, I'm looking to find the people that are in the real world and who
that sounds
are.
Like the first thing ever, but you would laugh your hands off, I think. Well, I'm also helping plan something. This is the third one where a group of, we'll call creatives of a certain age, have gotten together. This will be the third time. We've done it in Monterey and Santa Fe, oh, cool. along with a lot of activities and a party every evening. It's called Design Family Reunion. It's in Seattle next September. You might want to take a look at coming.
Oh my gosh! Yes, if we, absolutely. I think I've got an event in October. So I mean, if calendar's free, I'm coming.
Yeah, it's I think September 27th to October 1st next year. So
cool. Yeah, awesome. Good. All right, brother. Listen, I really appreciate it. I think this was fantastic.
Likewise.
I will be in touch, and I just can't thank you enough for taking some time.
That's a two-way street. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for joining me on another broadcast of Brushstrokes, a podcast powered by Canvas Magazine. Remember that this episode was sponsored by Conduit Incorporated, channeling content and connections. Conduit is there for all of your custom content needs. Visit www.conduit-inc.com. My thanks again to Terry. He was a wonderful guest, and I really, really appreciated his insight. I thought it was remarkable to hear how he's connecting with his clients, and regardless of the business, design, print, balloon manufacture, we all need to connect in a much different way in today's world. His humor, his positivity, and certainly his passion for print is really, really refreshing. So again, thanks so much to Terry. I really appreciate it. I hope you all enjoyed this episode of Brushstrokes. Tune in again in a couple weeks for our next episode. And until then, be the buffalo.